This is Fresh Air. Some victims of rape don't press charges because they're afraid they'll be victimized again in the courtroom. One of the people who has tried to change how the legal system deals with rape is my guest, Linda Fairstein. Since 1976, she's directed Manhattan's Sex Crimes Prosecution Unit, the first unit of its kind in the country. She's been involved with many high-profile trials. She prosecuted Robert Chambers in the so-called Preppy Murder case and worked on the Central Park Jogger case. She's written a new book about her work called Sexual Violence, Our War Against Rape. I asked Fairstein if she thinks the nature of sexual attacks is changing.
I don't think that the nature of rape attacks is changing. I think we're beginning to learn a lot more about attacks that have gone on, I'm sure, for decades. And I think there has always been an extraordinary amount of sexual violence that has gone unreported, and that's probably more true of crimes between acquaintances.
I'm wondering, too, if you think that crack, for instance, has increased the amount of sexual violence.
Most definitely. Yes, a change in that direction. I have often talked about the fact that when I started doing this work 2 decades ago, the drug of choice in most urban areas was heroin. And although people committed very violent crimes to get the money to buy heroin, once ingested, that drug was a depressant and put people out for a while. Crack, as you know, is a stimulant, and one of the problems, although it's cheap and readily available, after ingesting the crack, there is a lot of gratuitous violence in terms of criminal activity, and unfortunately, much of it is sexual activity.
So you think crack is related to rape?
I think in many, many instances in our urban areas, crack is related to forms of sexual assault. And I think the other trend in terms of differences that I would say I'd have to acknowledge is that a very disturbing increase in the frequency and nature of sexually violent crimes among teens and young, very young adolescents.
Well, does it seem to you that teenage boys have less respect for girls than ever before?
It seems like they have no respect for girls, yes. I mean, I think it is the level is at a frighteningly all-time low with cases that have been reported, as you know, in the news media all over the country, from violent assaults to the spur posse kind of situations in California to the whirlpool, swimming pool incidents we've had in every part of New York City this summer where gangs are attacking and surrounding young women in public swimming pools. It's a very, very alarming trend.
Are there special difficulties you're up against as a prosecutor when you're working with a young girl who's been raped? Is it harder to frame her testimony or anything like that?
Yes, it can be harder, often simply because of the developmental level of the young woman. If she's at a certain level, educational level, I mean, she may not be articulate enough. She's probably even more frightened than adults are about entering the criminal justice system. And that kind of apprehension can make it very difficult to gain her willing participation in the system. So all kinds of additional strains occur naturally when the victim is young.
Do you think that a lot of women are still afraid to press charges if they've been raped?
Yes, one of the things I try and do in the book is explain why they should not be and how significant the changes are in the legal system in the last 2 decades to enable more successful prosecutions and to demand more aggressive investigations in parts of the country where they're not being done. But the overall, I think, general reaction, if you were to ask your listeners, would be that women are generally apprehensive about entering the criminal justice system.
What are some of the arguments you use to convince women to press charges?
I begin with a very basic explanation of the system because an enormous amount has changed in just the last 15 years. The cases are surrounded by the myths that were based on actual fact. I call them myths because today they are not reality, but they were based on the fact of how bad our legal system was in every state in this country until 15 and 20 years ago. And so I think a lot of the fears are allayed by actual knowledge about how the system works and what the victim will or will not experience in the criminal justice system, what new laws have been passed, like the Rape Shield Law, to prevent the defense from cross-examining her about prior sexual history. And I think, secondly, women today, by and large, are much more interested in achieving justice in this area. There is increasingly, I'd like to believe, less stigma attached to victims of these crimes when they are informed and well-educated and enlightened about these issues. And the number of women who have successfully prosecuted and who say how cathartic it is to have had a day in court to confront the rapist and to be victorious over him, many of the stories I tell in my book reflecting that kind of triumph in the courtroom, which is something most victims don't expect when they come to the system. Those are two things that make participation, I think, very rewarding.
My guest is Linda Fairstein. She's the head of New York City's Sex Crimes Prosecution Unit. She's written a new book about her work called Sexual Violence, Our War Against Rape. We're going to take a short break. This is Fresh Air. Linda Fairstein is my guest. We're talking about her work as head of New York City's Sex Crimes Prosecution Unit. Can you estimate for us the percentage of cases that your unit takes on that is date and acquaintance rape as opposed to stranger rape?
Yes, I'd say it's at least 60% of what comes into the unit, some years more than that, but very high.
Much higher than it was when you took over the unit in
yes.
the 70s?
Yes.
What are some of the differences between stranger rape and acquaintance rape that lead to problems in the courtroom for you when you're prosecuting?
Okay. Generally, public attitudes, and that's our juries, much more supportive of victims in stranger rapes. It's everybody's worst nightmare about themselves and their loved one. Acquaintance rape, public opinion seems to support, seems to be less traumatic because the offender doesn't appear to be a career criminal. He usually is someone known and obviously trusted by the victim. Two, there's generally less violence, less force used in an acquaintance and date cases, often less injury, and so therefore it often seems to the jury less serious. And probably most important, it is the crime, sadly, viewed by many people as victim precipitated, as occurring because of something the victim has done to allow it to happen. Again, a false view, but she went to his house, she drank too much, she was wearing the wrong things. And if people on the jury buy those arguments, it's much tougher for the victim.
You make the point in your book, and this surprised me, that women jurors are more skeptical in date rape cases. I was very surprised to hear that.
It has been supported, sadly, by research all over the country. Obviously not well-informed, well-educated women, but sadly a lot of women tend to be more critical of the victim than men. Not true across the board, but we run into pockets where victims are attacked by jurors for their bad judgment, and women harsher on them than men. And the other factor is that women will more often base their judgment about a defendant's guilt on his physical appearance or class background than men will. Women will more frequently say, gee, a guy who looks like that wouldn't have to do that to get a date. Ludicrous, ridiculous, but proven all over this country.
Antioch University has instituted something that I'm only superficially acquainted with. I assume you're better acquainted with this than I am. That basically says that as sexual intimacy escalates between a couple, they have to give verbal consent every step of the way so that it's absolutely clear that there is mutual consent. Maybe you can explain that a little more and tell us what you think of it.
I don't think much of it because I'm familiar with it and with universities that are now requiring written consent, which I think is even more ludicrous. It's not the nature of human relationships and certainly not sexual relationships. And I think it's a well-intentioned but very foolhardy approach to the issue.
Would it help you as a lawyer?
Not at all.
Why not?
Well, I think it would then still become a credibility issue if you're talking about verbal consent after you kissed her, what did you say? Well, I asked her if she wanted to kiss me a second time, and she said yes. It would still come down to belief, disbelief of those facts, and I don't think it would bring anything to the table.
So it's still one person's word against another, huh?
Yes.
Now, you personally interview, I believe, about 250 rape victims a year to determine if there's sufficient evidence to prosecute. What do you need to prosecute?
Unlike 20 years ago, we really only need the word of the victim. And if she tells a credible, candid story, that's literally all we need. It's nice to have more. It's easier for her and therefore easier for a prosecutor if there's anything beyond her word. But testimony is sufficient as with any other crime.
Do you come across many women who seem to be making up the charge of rape to get even with somebody?
No, absolutely not. I talk about false reporting in the book. It's a phenomenon that does occur very, very rarely, very small significance, no greater than in any other crime. And what I do find, however, and my colleagues too, are cases where sometimes the victim will, who has been raped and has been the victim of a terrible crime, will not be candid about some other aspect of events before or after the crime, will deny alcohol use, will deny drug use because she thinks we won't take the case or law enforcement won't care about her. So a lot of those first interviews are for me getting the victim to understand how important it is, how essential it is that all of the details be exposed and be true.
Well, I guess if the defense attorney brings it out and you've neglected to, that will really make your client look bad.
It will probably knock the client out of the box. If she's left something out and that's the time it's discovered on the witness stand for the first time in front of a jury, you can pretty much bet on the fact that the jury will discredit a lot of the rest of her story.
How explicit do you like the victim to get on the stand? Because let's face it could be very embarrassing for her. It could be very embarrassing for the jurors, for the judge even.
True, but in most cases, it's the explicit testimony that will convict the offender. One of the things that we argue, especially in stranger cases, as you know from the book, is that what makes this crime different? It's not a mugging that happened in 2 minutes or 4 minutes. These crimes rarely occur in less than 15, 20 minutes. If the offender has the victim where she won't be found, it can be an hour or more. And it is the detail, it is the explicit nature of the language and the acts that often are the identifying features about a particular offender and are often the reason for the reliability of the victim's identification. And explaining that to a victim and saying, I know it's going to be uncomfortable, but you're going to be uncomfortable for 2 hours and then you're going to win. And when you give people a reason and you make them understand why and you can give them an end result that's consistent with their well-being, I don't get a lot of reluctance.
I want to ask you a little bit about jury selection. I know one of the things you have to eliminate for is if somebody has read about a trial, you know, or heard about, I mean, read about a case or heard about it, and you've handled some pretty well-known cases. Now, you know, it would seem that the most educated people, the people who are most likely to read newspapers and follow the news on TV and so on, are also the people who are most likely to be informed about what we know about rape and why it's committed and so on. They'd be the most enlightened about it. So in a way, you'd almost automatically be eliminating some of the people who would be most sympathetic to the view that you're going to present.
Boy, this is a great question. I think in all my years, you were the first interviewer to ever ask it. You're absolutely right. The standard, though, is not only that the victim, that the juror has heard or read about a case, but that it has formed an opinion that couldn't be changed by actual evidence. So it's okay in most cases to have read something, but if the judge then says, but can you keep an open mind till you've heard all the evidence? And most intelligent people can say yes. However, the point you had in all of the high profile cases, things like the Robert Chambers case and the Jogger case, in something like Chambers, where there was such an enormous amount of pretrial publicity, many, many people came into the jury room, and they were the people I wanted as jurors. They were intelligent. They read newspapers and watched news shows. And many, many, many of the 486 prospective jurors we went through to get 12 said, I couldn't possibly be fair and impartial in this trial. I have formed an opinion. And so all over the country, this is true. In the high-profile cases, it is a nightmare to try and pick a jury.
Well, one last question. Because you're exposed to rape all the time, has it made you more fearful about walking the streets of Manhattan?
No, I really think this job isn't for any of us who would become so paranoid by doing it. I will say, though, I mean, you're not far off. I think it's made me very careful and cautious. I'm quite aware of the terrible nature of this crime, and I'm quite aware of how little opportunity it takes for these crimes to occur in many circumstances. So I am cautious and careful, but I think I would leave any city I lived in if I became so frightened, or else I'd stop doing this kind of work. But the rewards are far greater than the fears that it instills.
Linda Feuerstein, I want to thank you very much for talking with us.
Thank you so much for your interest and attention to the matter.
Linda Fairstein directs Manhattan's Sex Crimes Prosecution Unit. Her new book is called Sexual Violence: Our War Against Rape. This is Fresh Air.